Lee Weiner.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, sir. Right off the bat, I have to get this straight with you. What do you prefer? Do you prefer Chicago 7 or Chicago 8?
Look, Chicago 7, how it became known most widely. Chicago 8, it was the conspiracy. I mean, you know, like, you know, it's all myth. So,
right.
You know, do I care? No.
We'll go with Chicago 7 because that's in the book, and we'll get to that in a little bit. You were a Southsider, born on the South Side, 74th and Colfax, right?
Absolutely true. Right on the, just on the correct side of the IC tracks.
There you go. You went to the U of I.
That's true.
That's where
also
you
true.
That's where you started your academia, so to speak, and you wound up there just because, right?
No, I certainly wasn't going to get anywhere else. I had a sort of a raggedy high school career.
Right. Now, when you were there, there's a story about a biology professor, I believe. This was in the book, that really got you into protesting, right?
Well, it was the first time that I used some of the lessons that I heard around my family and my family friends. Yeah. This guy wrote a letter into the university newspaper suggesting that if you were sufficiently mature and you thought about it a lot, you know, people might be able to consider having premarital sex before they got married. They fired his ass immediately. And a bunch of us thought that that was inappropriate, and we were at university, after all, free speech, blah, blah. And I got up on a top of a car with a megaphone to disrupt things in support of that particular guy in the notion of free speech.
And this, just to put it in context, this is early 60s, right?
1960.
Yeah.
As far as early in the 1960s as you can get.
Got it. It was at the University of Illinois, which is my alma mater, too, by the way.
you've got to tell me. So when I was going there,
yes,
it was always Champaign-Urbana, but now I see it's Urbana-Champaign. What made that change?
I don't know.
Way too off topic.
I don't know. When I was there, I was there from 79 to 85. Yes, that's 5 years. That's another story. But it was Urbana-Champaign when I was there too. And I guess maybe
I don't care.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Who cares? It's downstate Illinois, anyway.
There you go. It was there at the U of I that you got involved with the SDS, right? The Students for a Democratic Society.
No, they had not. They had begun, but we didn't know it. I mean, we were all that corn, all those farms. Nobody that I knew, in after. The same people that organized that free speech stuff very quickly moved into picketing around Woolworths in support of the civil rights movement in the South. We did not know, no one I knew that SDS had gotten started up in Ann Arbor. We just didn't know.
Yeah.
So it was not till a bunch of years later I got connected to SDS.
Right. So you graduate from the U of I, right?
This is true.
You go back up to Chicago and you get some jobs, a welfare caseworker, right?
Yes, that's true.
And then later you also did some work in Cabrini Green. What was that like?
There was things in between, but
right.
I was able to get a work as a community organizer and to try to help strengthen people to make changes and gain control over their own lives and achieve some degree of political power over their own communities. And Cabrini Green was part of the neighborhood. The good news is they're all torn down.
Right.
But when I was working there, it had a worse reputation than it actually was. At least when I was there, the gangs, individual gangs, were not everybody had a gun, and the individual groups did not control different buildings. It was difficult, it was harsh, and it was poor, and it was dangerous, but it wasn't like it became later.
Right, right. So you go to the University of Chicago for grad school, right?
This is true. I admit it.
And it was there that you founded CORE, right? Congress of Radical of Racial Equality?
It was at the University of Chicago. It was when I bumped into and ran into and began to connect to the people who were involved in what would ultimately become the movement with a capital M, that included people who were associated with CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. It was a ferment, a time where people were becoming more committed to acting politically in their own lives.
Got it.
And I was part of that surge of consciousness and getting connected to one another.
Then it was off to Hebrew University of Jerusalem, correct?
Yes. The family, I guess, wasn't completely thrilled by what I was talking about doing, riding buses into strange and dangerous southern cities. They decided that some degree of intervention was appropriate, and we were given a belated wedding present, my first wife and I. And we went to Israel for a little bit more than a year.
And that was kind of the idea, right? To get you away from that type of thing, right?
Absolutely correct. Their hope and intention was to reconnect me to my Jewish roots and shake all that this silly political stuff out of my head and go back to becoming a nice university professor or some damn thing. So it kind of backfired on them because I spent the year. That's where I first met Jerry Rubin. He and his brother Gil had similarly been shuffled off to Israel as a place to get out of America that was still considered okay. I spent the year with Arab and Jewish members of their Communist Party, doing an enormous amount of reading, visiting kibbutzim, the desert, Druze villages, Arab villages, and became ever more committed to coming back to the United States and making significant change here.
Right. Right.
So it kind of backfired on the family.
Just a bit, as it did for Jerry Rubin, too, right?
And he certainly did.
Obviously, yeah. Sure. I think it was right around this time, you're back in Chicago, and there was a little bit of a confrontation in a bar. I believe it was it in Old Town? Can you share that story?
I was working as a community organizer.
Right.
It was my first direct contact with the counterculture. It didn't go well. it was on Sedgwick, some ratty bar on the western edge of the gentrifying Old Town. Across the street from Old Town Garden, Marshall Field. I've forgotten what the name of the buildings were. Something Gardens. The community organization I was working with, we had gotten a federally chartered credit union. Rights to do that. In one that was not, that allowed the neighborhood to get into it. It was one of the first that was not associated with, you know, like a member of a union, for example.
Okay.
But we had a kind of deal with the guys who were running money on the street. And in some of the few remaining factories. So that led to these mob guys and some guys from and me and the from the organization having a meeting at a bar to work out a deal. That essentially the deal was we wouldn't give credit union membership to anybody who was white, and they would hassle our asses if we offered, you know, low interest loans to people who were black. But there was a guy singing. I'm allergic to beer, so everybody else was drinking beer. I was drinking whiskey. And there was this young guy whose name I recognized because I knew his father's music. It was Arlo Guthrie. Mm-hmm. He was up on a small short stage, making a lot of noise singing. And I was just pissed off. We were in a dangerous, difficult negotiation. So I got up and told him to get his ass off the stage and leave us alone. Not a good introduction to the comic culture, but there it was.
You yanked Arlo Guthrie off the stage. That's just
I suggest that he leave.
Okay, all right. Thank you for the comment.
I mean, it made that suggestion in a very strong and aggressive manner.
And you had backup with you, which is good.
Well, you know, it was a tough looking crowd at the table, I suspect.
It's always good to have backup now, isn't it? We're going to move on to the summer of 1968 next. That's after this update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN. Seven. Phil Minicky for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. A couple things about what we just heard. Yes, the whole world is watching. Those were tracks 1 and 2. They kicked off side 4 of the Chicago Transit Authority album. And it was titled Prologue, August 29th, 1968, and Someday, August 29th, 1968. The band was cool enough to A, use that actual audio and put it on a record, and B, name the quote-unquote songs after that historic date. That's cool, and that's true Chicago. Blood on the Streets in the Town of Chicago, indeed. The Doors from Morrison Hotel right there, back with Lee Weiner of the Chicago 7. So, it's the summer of 1968. You're a doctoral candidate teaching assistant at Northwestern, correct?
True.
And
this is true. You've obviously read the book. Thank you.
It's an awesome book. We'll talk more about that in just a little bit. It was very important to you and others that this be a peaceful protest during the convention. This is the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, right? It was important to be peaceful, right?
I mean, I get my ass cracked. Of course, it was important to be peaceful.
Could it have been? I mean, we're looking at it in hindsight, obviously, without all the police activity. Mayor Daley basically had an offer to shoot to kill arsonists, shoot to maim looters. Was there any chance of it being peaceful?
Not a lot. One could hope. I mean, I was in those days, and I suppose still now, I'm a little more of a hard ass politically than some other folks, and so I was not particularly optimistic about the one could be hopeful mostly I was hoping that when violence occurred, that demonstrators would not be badly hurt. Mm-hmm. By the summer of 1968, I had friends. Jerry Rubin was one of my oldest friends. Through him, I had met Abby Hoffman, and the whole crew of folks in the Lower East Side in Manhattan that ultimately became the Yippies. I had knew Rennie from his community organizing days in Chicago on the North Side when he was up in Uptown, working in an organization called Join, I think you remember. Jobs for Income Now. So I knew folks in both groups of people who were planning demonstrations in Chicago in 68. And so I was kind of active in terms of helping train marshals, that is, folks, demonstrators, who would take on the responsibility and the obligation to try to keep demonstrators safe.
Because you were the Chicago connection. You knew the area, you knew the guys, you knew
very much so, yeah.
The layout of the parks and all of the above, right?
True. That's also correct.
Now, the numbers that I have, I mean, you see different numbers, but there were allegedly like 12,000 Chicago police, 7,500 from the Army, 6,000 National Guard. That's over 25,000 troops there to maintain the calm, so to speak.
Yes, we had one rock band. And maybe, I don't know, later people said, oh, 5,000, 10,000 demonstrators. I actually never counted, so I don't know. I will say there did seem to be a lot more people with in uniforms than there were people with long hair.
Things got out of hand, obviously. Would you consider this the darkest moment in Chicago's history?
I would think probably the fire in 1871 was a little worse.
Right.
I think that the uprising after Martin Luther King's death earlier in 1968 was pretty difficult. Mm-hmm. I don't know where the demonstrations in 68 or our trial in 69 fit on a spectrum of bad things or difficult things. Some of those things were not bad as much as they were difficult. They were necessary and important. That's the way I feel about the demonstrations in Chicago in 68. And, you know, and the trial, you know, 69, 70, didn't work out so terrible. So,
right.
You know.
Right. You found out about the indictment when you were at home from a New York Times reporter's phone call, right?
True. I walked in. My mother-in-law, who was had been babysitting with our young son, had heard the news. And when I walked in, she was just like, she's not really speaking coherently. Very, very upset. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. But then a New York Times reporter called and asked me how I felt about things.
And you were blown away by this. It's like, I'm sorry, what? Because, I mean, Abby Hoffman's name was mentioned. Dave Rubin's name was mentioned.
We used to talk. I mean, once the Republicans were in and are clearly going to indict people, my friends and I and everybody else, we would debate, you know, who's going to get indicted and make these lists. My name never was on any of those lists. I mean, you know, really.
Right.
There are lots of people who are more active and more prominent and more deserving of what turned out to be a somewhat perverse honor to be indicted. It's in those days, I had really long hair and a long beard. I was a student associated with the university. A couple of undercover cops. I mean, the police department kind of knew me from my work in the city earlier, and the head of the Red Squad of Chicago testified at the trial. I said, "Oh, yeah, we know Lee Weiner for a long time. We knew all about him." Anyway, so that, you know, and I shot off my mouth, and I was fairly active, and so I kind of stood in at the trial for all the long-haired students.
Right.
So that was my role. That was my job.
There were a lot of undercover cops. Irwin Brock is the name of the undercover cop that you were conversing
you're
with.
You're right. Thank you. I'd forgotten his goddamn name.
sorry to bring that
up. No, it's all right. It's cool. I mean, like, it was, Irv was, had a series of roles in the anti-war movement in Chicago, very prominent. He's part of the boards of one organization or another, the Vets Against the War, things like that. But yeah, he had me shoot off my mouth.
Yeah. Which led to the charge of teaching demonstrators how to construct incendiary devices that would be used to disrupt interstate traffic. That was the official charge.
What a great charge that was. I mean, really, think about it.
Yeah. So we're at the trial. This may cause some pain. Judge Julius J. Hoffman, was he biased a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the charm of it is that, you know, so there's like 3-4 movies about the trial, and all of them characterize the judge fairly well because a lot of them are using the trial transcripts. So yeah, often the judge was beyond bias.
Yeah.
Determined to put us away for as long as he possibly could, as quickly as he possibly could.
Right. You mentioned movies. Let's talk about that next after this break. Lee Weiner of the Chicago 7 here at 720 WGN. Mm-hmm. 1049, Phil Manekian for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking with Lee Weiner of the Chicago 7. You see him portrayed in the current Netflix film, The Trial of the Chicago 7, as a clean-cut guy. He was not. He had a beard and an afro at the time. Okay, Lee, there have been quite a few movies made about your ordeal.
This is true. I know four. I think there was a fifth one, there's been a bunch. Jeremy Kagan's movie, which I guess is available on Amazon Prime. I seem to remember I saw that recently again. Was one of the first, maybe was the first. And Jeremy's stuff was basically using his interviews with us. We all knew him. And he'd gotten some money from HBO.
Right.
And created a movie about, you know, using basically the transcripts.
This was a 1987 movie, Conspiracy, The Trial of the Chicago 8, on HBO.
Right.
There's actual footage in that, which was really, really cool, of in the beginning of the film, Mayor Daley is on, it's an actuality of him talking about law and order.
Yeah.
Does that sound familiar?
Oh, all too well. Then I think, we were, I think in the actual movie, we were there as the movie was being shot. Jeremy, ultimately, Tom Hayden said, "Oh, we ought to come out here and see it." And so we all did. So we ended up, mostly all of us together, out in Hollywood, and Jeremy did some filming around us. So that was kind of cool.
In that film, Mayor Daley was on the stand. Mayor Daley was never on the stand in the trial, right?
He was.
He was.
Yeah, we called him as a witness. So the defense called him as a witness and wanted him determined as a hostile witness. And the judge said to us to our lawyers, you know, no, he's really a nice guy and he's doing great. So no, I'm not going to declare him a hostile witness. So yeah, no, he was on the stand.
Now in that movie, there's a scene where Abby wants to fight him. Did that actually happen in court?
Well, you know, yeah, well, yeah, you know, yes. It did. I mean, I get asked a lot of questions about, you know, would that really happen in the movie? Yeah, it was a strange trial. It was. If you want to have a political trial, you know, ours was a great political trial.
Well, that that brings up the question that Abby was adamant that this is a political trial, and William Kunstler, your lawyer, one of your lawyers, initially said there is no such thing as a political trial. But it
that's only in a movie or two.
Okay.
No, Billy. There was no question on our side about it was a political trial. I mean,
yeah.
Nobody was trying to figure out guilt or innocence for what happened on the streets of Chicago in '68. It was designed to punish and frighten people.
Right.
And we resisted that and showed and demonstrated in that trial that, in fact, resistance to injustice can occur and is necessary and possible, both on the streets against brutal police, as well as in the courts, in the biased courts.
Mm-hmm.
That resistance to injustice is both possible and necessary in both those places.
Right. Now, they had actualities of all of you guys in it, and your closing quote in the movie was, "I would hope that my children would do their political work even better than I did mine, and I'm doing mine now." That was you in the movie.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's like some fathers and lots of fathers and sons talk about their baseball teams when they were young and how the baseball, the football, their favorite football team was now, and they had those kinds of conversations with their sons. Most recently, I was having a conversation with one of my sons about the different quality of gas used in rioting situations in Chicago in '68 and the difference in the gas that they're using in Portland this past summer.
Got it. More specifics.
Well, you know, it's not a sports team, but it seems to be, you know, a recurring event in the family life.
Right. Another movie came out in 2007. You alluded to it, which was animated, which was a rather interesting movie. It was called Chicago 10. The part that I liked about it most is there was really, really good actual footage of the demonstrations in that. That was incredible.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah.
I agree.
And it was very weird with the animation, though. All the court scenes were animated, and it was very interestingly done.
Yeah, and pretty accurate.
Yeah, okay.
It really was.
Would you consider that the most accurate?
I don't know. Because, I mean, first of all, I haven't seen that film for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Look, each of these, we're talking about myths.
Right.
We're talking about the ability to show and tell people mm-hmm. that acting politically against injustice, which I was talking about earlier, is both possible and necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And these films actually are fairly successful in doing that.
Right.
So that I'm cool with that.
Yeah. There was another film in 2011 called Chicago 8, which to me kind of wanted to get to the heartstrings of some of the people involved, including Judge Hoffman. And I'm like, really? That was interesting, I thought.
That may be the movie I don't remember.
Yeah. Now, in this, there were a couple questions that I have to ask because, again, you were in court, and Hollywood takes their liberties. They want to embellish things. It's more fiction. It's exaggerations.
It's a movie, you know?
Right. Exactly. It's for entertainment. Phil Oakes, he was in court, correct?
Yep.
And they according to the movie, they did not allow him to sing, but he recited the lyrics to some songs, right?
That's true. It was a friend.
Yeah. Yeah. There were quite a few friends that were involved. your buddy Arlo Guthrie was in court, right?
Yes, Arlo Guthrie was I wouldn't call him a buddy, but yeah. I mean, look, yes, we had a lot of people testify. both from the counterculture and from politics and straight world politics, as well as alternative politics, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Allen Ginsberg, the poet, was there.
Allen, wonderful. He was great.
Timothy Leary was there.
Yes.
Judy Collins, she sang in court as well, right?
Yes, she did. She was very brave, and she did.
I remember meeting her and falling in love, the bluest eyes I've ever seen in my life.
That's true. You are not the only person to have fallen in love with her.
The song is true, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. Norman Mailer was in court as well. Somebody who was not in court, who you spoke to, was Groucho Marx. You guys wanted him to come to court to talk about humor and satire, right?
Yes, we got his, somebody who was in court got his, somebody from Hollywood, gave us his personal number, and I got to be the one to call him.
How was that?
It was great. It was great. Well, almost without question, I was a little stoned.
Of course.
He was great. He said things like, you know, he was honored to be asked, but he thought because of his last name, Marx, that the judge would disregard anything he would have to say. But he was great.
How sad is that? That you have to keep that into account during a trial. And you guys were on trial for some important stuff. You were looking at 10 years here.
10 years in, yeah. They were not playing around.
Yeah. Jeez. All right, a couple quick questions just about the validity of movies. Did you guys all stay in the same office, the conspiracy office in Hyde Park, during the trial? Were you all staying there?
No.
Okay.
We were, for the most part, we were scattered around. There were four apartments for people in Hyde Park, but we're not all in the same place.
Got it.
There were a couple of big apartments, but, you know, I lived separately from most people, you know, there's not a single place. And our office was on Jackson in Loop.
We're going to hear about someone who was in court, sort of. That's next after this update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN.
So your brother's bound and gagged, and they've chained him to a chair. Won't you please come to Chicago? To sing.
9 minutes past 11 o'clock, Phil Minicky for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. That Graham Nash song, Chicago, from the year 1971, mentions something that actually happened in federal court here in Chicago. More on that in a bit as our conversation with Lee Weiner of the Chicago 7 continues. Ramsey Clark, who was President Lyndon Johnson's attorney general, he was in court testifying, right, Lee?
Yes, he was. Not in front of the jury, but he testified, yes.
The scene in the movie, the Netflix one that just came out in 2020, powerful stuff, really, really powerful stuff with him, just adamant about being on your guy's side. That was cool.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's like, it wasn't quite that explicit and dramatic,
right?
But it was pretty good, and his testimony was very positive towards us in relationship to who was responsible for the violence in the streets of Chicago. But the judge did not allow his testimony to be presented to the jury.
Mm-hmm. That could have changed things just a little bit, couldn't it have?
I don't know. The jury was pretty well divided. There was a faction, it turns out later, we found out there was a faction of four people who didn't think we were guilty of much of anything, and there were other people on the jury who thought we were guilty of everything. So, you know, right. I don't know whether Ramsey's testimony would have moved that particular dynamic very much.
Got it. In the movies, it was kind of portrayed that Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden were really at odds. Is that true?
There were differences, okay? There were differences. I mean, and that that Tom and Abby had different perspectives. Tom was very determined to run it as a real trial, a traditional trial. And Abs understood, I think, that it was an event.
Right.
And it was not a trial which was going to be won or lost only in the courtroom.
It was more theater to Abby Hoffman, right?
I think, yeah. And pretty much right.
Yeah.
It's a dramatic retelling. It's true. I mean, Abby and Jerry and Tom and Ren.
Right.
Ready? We had differences. We had different perspectives on how to convey the importance of acting politically,
right,
to people, and that such and political work could be done and could be effective. We all wanted that. We all believed that that was required to both stop the war and change America, and racism and an exploitative capitalist system. How we achieved that, what were the individual steps, what were the style? We had those kinds of differences, but what the hell?
Yeah. One of the things that caught my attention in this Netflix movie was that even though they were at odds, they respected each other to a degree. Abby, in the movie, saying that he read everything that Tom Hayden wrote.
Look, we were comrades in a struggle,
right,
against injustice, against evildoers. So yeah, we get angry at one another. Some people drink, somebody drink dope, and some, you know, I mean, so yeah, there were differences, but we were united in that trial. Nobody ever thought about getting a separate lawyer.
Right. I mean,
really, it was like we were together in that thing.
Right.
Let's
talk about Bobby Seale for just a little bit. Actually, okay. Physically bound and gagged in court. Really?
Yes. Four or five days. Yeah, pretty bad. I think that the one of the things that none of the movies capture, something I talk about in my book, is that our reactions, the other seven defendants, we were acting in relationship to this event as Bobby wanted us to act, which is to allow the conflict to be between him and the judge entire. And for the most part, that's what we did. You ended up holding on nails, your own fingernails into the palms of your hand, holding on to the edge of the table in terms of anger and upset. But we tried for the most part to allow that to play out the way Bobby wanted it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty ugly and it was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And ultimately, at one point, there was a physical fight between the marshals and the defendants.
Mm-hmm.
When they overturned Bobby's chair and things got a little raggedy for a little while.
But just to see this in federal court is, to me, is like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, they weren't kidding.
Yeah. So it's August of 2020 and you write a book. Why?
That's true.
Why now?
Well, I had a chance to take a deep breath. I've been working up until a couple of years ago, doing work for politicians and nonprofit organizations and trying to make it at least incremental difference, a ameliorative difference, if not a structural one. And I did not want, I didn't want the notion of politics being magical to I needed to try to crack down that notion, because it's not. It's something. Politics is being political. Is, I think, part of being a human being, being your best self. And I wanted to be able to convey that, and I wanted to be able to find. I thought there were some lessons in terms of what occurred in 68, 69, and before, and there were appropriate lessons for people in the here and now, in 2020.
Got it.
And that's why I wrote the book.
Conspiracy to Riot, The Life and Times of One of the Chicago Seven is the name of the book on Belt Publishing. A really, really good read, an easy read. And
thank you.
To wrap things up, what's your proudest moment? Where do you think you made the biggest difference?
Politically?
Yeah.
I wish I could ask that. Surviving and continuing to fight politically, I suppose.
There you go.
Never having let go of the goals and working towards whatever I could do to achieve an end of racism, sexism. Supporting people and their struggles to be free in a very ugly culture and a brutal capitalist world.
There you go.
So I kept doing that through my working life as best I could, and so I wrote the book. I don't know. I'm just hanging in. That's my accomplishment.
There you go. I
kept fighting. How's that? As best I could.
If no one else says thank you, I want to thank you on behalf of so many people, I'm sure. Thank you for all you did, Lee. We really, really appreciate that. And thank you for joining us on 720 WGN.
Very sweet of you.